on weeknights from 6
on 2FM.
Well, a big thanks to Afric and the Two Johnnies for the afternoon entertainment. It is Tuesday, May 14th, and you're listening to Game On with me, Shane Dawson, alongside Ruby Walsh. Coming up between now and 7pm, Stephen Kelly and Mark Langdon are with us ahead of a big night in London, where Spurs could help arch rivals Arsenal by toppling City. And given the news that Talca Park is officially saved, I'll be getting Stephen's memories on playing for Ireland in the iconic North Dublin venue.
Now let's put Shane Dawson in really good form. In rugby, we'll hear from the newly appointed Ulster head coach Richie Murphy and speak to Michael Cochrane on what the province can hope to achieve in the future. The Giro Italia continues to entertain, so cycling journalist Shane Stokes has the latest on one of the great Grand Tours, and John Kenny dials in from Clontarf, where Pakistan are on the charge as they chase down Ireland in the final T20 international of the series.
As always, if you want to have your say, you can text us on 51552, WhatsApp 087-187-9200, or we are on X at Game On 2FM.
Game On 2FM.
Good evening. Welcome along to the show. Ruby Walsh, a very happy birthday.
Oh, thank you very much, Shane Dawson.
Did you enjoy your day?
Couple of years' time, my appearance will start to reflect my age.
Many years' time, Ruby. Many years' time.
Oh, no, Shane. It's the other way around for me, I'm afraid.
A very happy birthday to the BAFTA-winning birthday boy as well, Ruby. I'm going all in with the compliments today.
Oh, you're going big, aren't you?
Your horse racing coverage on ITV?
ITV Racing won a BAFTA for its coverage of the first day of the Cheltenham Festival in 2023. I suppose it was the hours, Shane, surrounding Constitution Hill, but more so Honeysuckle winning the Mayor's Hurdle, and the scenes and the emotion of that 15 minutes, I suppose. It was one of those, I suppose, moments that you will always remember where you were there. I will anyway, especially when you think of the Bromhead family and Jack the Bromhead and what Honeysuckle meant. And it was just the camera work and the crowd and the atmosphere and the outpouring of emotion as she came back into the parade ring. It was incredible television, so fair play to Richard Willoughby, Paul McNamara and all the ITV team for that BAFTA. I was just sat in the truck talking over shots that they were providing Shane, so it had very little to do with me.
Always so humble, Ruby. Always so humble.
Well, it's a funny one, and we were talking about GAA goal last night.
Yeah.
I suppose when I was a professional sports person, you have no idea of the amount of people that go into a production, a live sports production. And I do sit in a truck for ITV behind the grandstand in the TV compound, and just to watch the amount of people that are involved in actually getting the pictures off the track or off a pitch into a truck, making them viewable and beam them to wherever they go to. It costs an absolute fortune, and there's a lot of people behind the cameras doing a lot of work.
A lot of really talented, highly skilled people as well.
And like VT operators, technicians, graphics. It's just incredible to watch them all do what they do. And I guess, look, you only ever see the people in front of the camera, but for every one in front of the camera, there's the multitudes behind it.
No, absolutely. I completely echo your sentiments. Last night you were talking about GAA Go. I'm sure you might have caught the news as well, Ruby, that there's a 250-year leasehold on Talca Park that's been officially approved.
Yeah, we were just discussing this before we came on air, because obviously my knowledge of soccer grounds in Dublin, and I was surprised when you were telling me, all the other teams that play in Talca Park, not just Shells. You rattled out three or four more clubs that play there.
I was mentioning off air to you, Ruby, the likes of Merino FC, Drumcondra AFC, Home Farm, local clubs in the area that have supported the Save Talca Park campaign to ensure that this football ground continues to serve the local community, that it isn't just for one club and it's not just for a League of Ireland senior team. It also provides a quality of access, which is something I didn't mention off air to you as well, in terms of ensuring that there is a home for both Shelburne men's and women's team, because that was the big elephant in the room with the original deal with Dalymount Park, that the women's side of things would have been left to play in substandard facilities elsewhere, and they weren't taken into account. And I think that was something that was very important in overcoming a lot of obstacles to ultimately achieve.
Let's simplify this now, right? Mm. So you've won the battle. You hardcore Shells fans, you've won the battle.
Local residents as well, and, exactly, and community groups, and it's not just Shells fans. I think it's important to note.
Now the hard part. Where is the money coming from to renovate it?
Well, I think football in general can't be left behind. A lot of other sports in Ireland avail of grants and great avail of funding, and perhaps, yes, admittedly, the FEI, the house hasn't been in order and they haven't been on the right footing, perhaps they haven't knocked on the right doors, but it's important for the state to provide long overdue funding that is not just needed for Tolka Park, that is needed for other League of Ireland grounds, Finn Park, Sligo Rovers, Dalymount, Richmond Park, and is also needed for association football in Ireland as a whole. This isn't just a senior level thing. There needs to be adequate facilities because participation rates are just going to keep increasing. Population is going up. It's not the most popular. I don't have stats or figures in front of me, but it's one of the most popular sports in Ireland. So there needs to be facilities. There needs to be these areas regained and regenerated as well, I think is the important thing. So there's numerous state funding mechanisms that do absolutely need to be tapped into.
It's going to take a few quid because Tolka Park and Dalymount Park, just mentioning two, Shane, that I have been in my life, are both in need of a major facelift, I would say.
No, and they are. They both have their authentic and they usher in the beauty of authenticity. But they absolutely need to be regenerated, as I said, and redeveloped, and hopefully that will happen. It's a 250-year leasehold for Tolka in particular, and it's not going to be something that happens overnight. Rome wasn't built in a day, but hopefully, gradually, we will see improvements because, you know, you have to strike while the iron's hot and all of that, etc., because they're sold-out stadiums across the league, so the appetite is there from the public, from the sporting public, from fans. So it's important now that we realise that this is something that needs to be cherished.
What would you like to see, Tolka Park? What would your ideal be for a capacity? What should it be? What should it... 5,000? 6,000?
I'd love to see 6,000 to 8,000, maybe. And I'm not saying that's going to be filled every Friday, but just to kind of have it. It's not about capacity for me. It's more about just the facilities there and to ensure that it's a welcoming stadium that you could bring kids to, you can bring your family to, that and that starts from the ground up.
Better than Old Trafford?
Yeah, and seeing the scenes in Old Trafford, I was really sad. I'm not a Manchester United fan, but seeing that in an iconic stadium like that, given, and it was, I know everyone's thought it was just like their leaky defence, etc., but it's sad to see a stadium in disrepair like that.
A picture paints 1,000 words.
I know, but listen, other sports get a lot of funding, and I think it's now time for people to realise and for the state to realise and for government to realise that football needs part of that too, that we need to work together collectively, and that is within the FEI as well, that there needs to be a collective effort to ensure that these grounds do get improved and we're not left with leaking roofs and scenes similar to Old Trafford.
I'll tell you what's more now. We better go to John Kenny soon.
We will. And John Kenny's in...
We only need 21 runs and 27 balls to win. This could be over before we get there if we go there soon.
It's all happening, JK, at Clontarf, which is another beautiful little gem of a cricket stadium, JK.
It is, yeah, it's fabulous here. It's the home, it's quintessential home of Irish cricket, really, before they move to Malahide and their pop-up stadium. They hope to have their main stadium in Abbottstown in a couple of years' time. But that's for the future. Pakistan heading for victory here. They need 179 in this third and deciding game, T20-wise. Pakistan put Ireland into bat. There are 163 for three now. Mohammad Rizwan made 55 and Barbara Azam, their captain, made 75. When Ireland were asked to bat first, they made 178 for seven in their innings, losing the way towards the end of their 20 overs and being given a decent start by Andy Balbirnie. who made 35, and their standing captain, Lorcan Tucker. He made his second half century in a row. His 73 had Ireland at one stage on 100 for one at one point. Tucker captaining the side as Paul Sterling was surprisingly rested for this series decider. Shaheen Shah Afridi, the pick of the bowlers for Pakistan, taking three for 17 off his four overs. Only really Harry Tector who made an unbeaten 30, really adding to Ireland's tally as they kind of tail away towards the end. Pakistan captain Babar Azam, I mentioned him there, coming to the crease, really got into the Irish attack. He reaches half century off 30 balls, while Azam, who was dropped earlier on by George Dockrell on 23, raced past 50. He hit the unfortunate Ben White for 25 runs in the 14th over, which included four huge sixes off that. And the poor old Graham Hume, he dropped two catches in the previous matches and he's just dropped another one here as well. So things not going Ireland's way. 167 for three now, Pakistan, off 16 overs. They need 179 for victory. So what do they need? 12 from four overs. So that should be a dolly for them.
It certainly should. Just before I let you go, John, you mentioned Lorcan Tucker. Great display from the standing captain. Paul Sterling, he's not injured, from what I understand.
No, I was talking to the selectors before, during the game, and I was asking what was going on. They said, OK, we've got games against the Dutch and Scotland to come. That's four games in Amsterdam after this series. And then they go to the World Cup, where they're playing India and Canada in New York before they play Pakistan in Florida towards the end of June. So with that in mind, and they have a 15-man squad, they have to try to give everybody a game. Neil Rock came in today as well for Gareth Delaney, who had a groin problem. But I was surprised, actually, that Paul Sterling was just rested, the Irish captain, the white ball captain. And there's another a chance for Ireland to get a nick of the wicket. Yes, they have. Nice catch, Curtis Camfer on the boundary. So four wickets down now, but still inside a victory. But I was surprised that they rested Sterling, but he was out there fielding earlier on in the warm-ups, so nothing wrong with him at all. But Tucker came in as a captain for the first time in any format of the game, and which is surprisingly because Andy Balberny is the test captain. He's out playing there today, and Harry Tector is also captain of the side in the past. So anyway, I think they're just moving things around, moving the pieces in the board. Obviously, this is an important series, but I think they're looking long-term and the T20 World Cup as well. Give everybody a chance and maybe give Graham Hume some catching practice, because poor Stuart Hume has been dropping the balls left, right and centre. And unfortunately, the last time he dropped the ball, he was right in front of the media tent, so that didn't help.
Not anyway, ideal.
Pakistan lost another wicket now, so 167 for four. They need 179 for victory. But they should do that in the next couple of minutes.
Okay, good stuff, John Kenny at Clontarf Cricket Ground there. Stephen Kelly and Mark Langdon are on the way to join us. Before we hear from them, let us hear from both Pep Guardiola and Ange Postecoglou ahead of the big Premier League clash this evening.
A proportion of your fans won't want you to win this game. How do you feel about that and the potential atmosphere it might create?
A proportion of our fans. What does that mean?
Difficult to say. Difficult to say how many.
Really? What, 50%? 20%? 1%? Just give me a rough estimate in your mind.
I don't know.
You don't know? Okay. Let's answer a question we don't know the answer to. That's fine. People are allowed to feel the way they do, but I think I've been, again, really consistent and I think really strong in my beliefs that, you know, it's important for this football club to get to where we want to A, not look for some silver bullet that's going to get us to where we want to. It's hard work, it's perseverance, it's resilience, it's quality that'll get us what we want. Not to fall for any sort of false dawns or any short-term result reactions, stick to the course. And thirdly, know what real success looks like. Real success looks like trophies. Anything else in between, bragging rights, whatever it is absolutely meaningless to me, to anyone involved with me. We've got a game tomorrow we want to win.
How might the players handle that atmosphere, though? Do you think it'll have an impact?
What atmosphere? You haven't told me. So you think the majority of our fans... I don't see it that way. I think the majority of our fans will create the atmosphere they've always created at our home games. And as I said, irrespective, we've got a game of football to win, and that's what we're going to try and do.
Pep, you're probably aware that a lot of Tottenham fans actually want their team to lose to you to stop their North London rivals, Arsenal, from winning it. In all your experience as a player and a manager, can that transfer, that kind of atmosphere, transfer to the players and make them less motivated? What do you expect from
Tottenham? I give you my advice. Don't ask these questions to Ange, the players. Don't do it. Don't ask them. We'll be offended.
Yeah, it'll be disrespectful.
We'll be offended. I never imagined one player, one manager don't prepare the game to win it. And maybe they had a chance to qualify for the Champions League. Of course, the rival is the rival, but when you see your team, you want to play good, and they will be their best. I'm pretty sure of that.
Hi, Pep. You obviously very calm all the time, despite what's going on. Sir Alex Ferguson used to call this time of the season squeaky bum time.
Translate.
Oh. That's going viral.
Squeaky bum time, as in... emphasis on the posterior. Yes.
Lots of pressure. It means that things are happening because of the pressure on you.
Yeah, physically. So I'm just wondering, will you be nervous, you know, yourself? Will you experience squeaky bum time yourself?
Of course I will feel it. Otherwise it will be a bad sign. Every game I feel the right tension, but at the same time, as much I know the opponent and focus what they have to do and to read what happened during the game, it is nice to have that feeling. I don't think any competitor, football player or managers, they are not relaxed, like say, that doesn't matter. But of course, we know we are playing for. So it's a no kite. It's like a quarterfinal, semifinal, second leg, Champions League or FA Cup. Like it's not back, not get back. So it's simple. Win, okay, lose, bye-bye. So it's not much complicated.
Everyone deals with pressure in a different way, but I think when sports people, including managers, answer questions with a question, it's usually a sign of pressure. Stephen Kelly and Ange wasn't having it. Pep wanted to know what squeaky bum time was, but I loved Ange Postecoglou. Mm. Give me a percentage of Spurs fans that don't want them to win tonight. That really put someone in their place, didn't it?
Yeah, you can only respond to a certain way, isn't it? Like you're being asked here, are you basically sending your team out to lose? Like no manager's going to admit to that or in any way condone it. Listen, most Tottenham fans are probably in a position where they're so torn because they don't want to see their team lose, but they don't want Arsenal to win the league. And the get out of jail free card is the fact that it's Man City, so it's kind of acceptable to lose to Man City, which I know it's never acceptable to lose to anybody. But it's kind of acceptable to lose to probably one of the best teams in the world. So, you know, they probably thought we've lost to worse teams than this over the season. So if we lose to Man City, it's not going to be a big thing. But for the manager and the players, you don't go out thinking like that. You really don't. You know, it just doesn't happen. You'll know yourself, Ruby. Anybody that's played a sport at a professional level, as soon as you cross the right line, you want to win. That's what it comes down to. You know, I've got my fan head on now. I'm going, I don't think I could stomach it if we were to win and hand Arsenal the title. But again, I still want my team to win.
Of course you do. But Mark Langdon, who joins us as well, Spurs, since they went to Newcastle a little over a month ago, haven't really been hitting their straps in the Premier League, have they?
Oh, no, they haven't, Ruby. And I think Stephen hit the nail on the head there where, you know, discussing what Spurs fans want to happen and what Ange Postecoglou wants to happen. I mean, they haven't really got that much say in it. If Man City play to the levels that they're capable of, that you know, they should go on to win the game. I was at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium on Saturday for that 2-1 victory over Burnley. It was deserved in the end from Spurs, but first half performance wasn't particularly good. They were obviously coming into that off the back of four straight defeats, including that Newcastle game, the Arsenal one when they were 3-0 down at half time, the Chelsea one where they were 2-0 down, and sort of it was only then that they started to play. Liverpool, they were 4-0 down before they started to play. So, you know, they're going to have to put in a sort of season's best performance, really, to have any chance of winning. And despite what Ange Postecoglou says, the atmosphere is not going to be like a normal Tottenham home game. You know, most of the fans, I think, would accept sort of losing this game.
I actually think there's a possibility our fans might cheer if City win the game. Genuinely, I think that could potentially happen.
Sorry, I just can't wrap my head. Sure, like, even for the team I support, surely your support for your team should trump anything any rival does. Like, would Spurs fans not be bigger? I know it would effectively hand Arsenal the title, but it's about Spurs. They're going for top four still, albeit slim chances, but they're still, they want to finish up high as possible. So I just can't wrap my head around why you would ever want your own team to lose, regardless of any rivalry, Stephen.
Yeah, I know. I can't get my head around it, but from a playing perspective, I can't.
Yeah.
But from a fan's perspective and being the other side of it now, I'm going, like, do I really want Arsenal to win the league? Listen, I played in the game the last time Arsenal won the league at White Hart Lane. So, you know what I mean? I'm not sure I want
What was that like for you personally?
It was my first ever North London derby, and it was horrendous. Like, I came away from it. We drew 2-2, but the Invincibles went on to win the league, probably arguably one of the greatest teams ever. And, you know, you don't want Arsenal to start getting back to those levels, especially with us off, you know, not close to them. And it's all about bragging rights, and Ange hit the nail on the head about trophies, about getting to a team that's actually achieving something tangible, not just, you know, something over your local rivals. But the rivalry is enormous, and I've played in that game, and I've come away after games and our coach has been smashed, and there's been times when things have happened and you're going, it's a crazy match, and the rivalry is off the charts. So I can totally understand where the fans are coming from after playing in it, that they would not want them to win the league. But in saying that, there's something in me that's saying there'll be nothing more Spurs like than us going and beating City and giving them the title. that would kind of sum it up, wouldn't it?
But Mark, when you look at it, City have won their last seven by at least 2 goals. Ange is not really a defensive minded manager. He'll want his side to attack. This is going to be a good game for a neutral.
It absolutely will be. I mean, the reverse fixture was 3-3. Tottenham went into that game with no centre-halves available. Emerson Royale and Ben Davies played centre-back. At times, City looked like, you know, they could have hit sort of 6 or 7 in that game. They only managed 3. And in the attacking third, Tottenham were able to cause enough problems, because there are very few teams that do attack City. You know, even if you think back to that game against Arsenal at the Etihad a couple of months ago, Arsenal were quite content to play for that 0-0 draw. And Tottenham have done very well against Manchester City using defensive tactics at home in sort of recent Premier League games under Conte, Mourinho and Nuno. This is a very different Tottenham way of playing, but they do then leave themselves really exposed defensively, and the top teams have all managed to kind of punish them in that regard. And I'd be surprised if City don't score a couple of goals this evening. I could easily see Tottenham scoring as well, but in those kind of sort of games where you just go end to end, I think you'd always take City to win a game like that, just because of the extra quality they've got in the final third if you do try and sort of go sort of punch to punch with them.
I have a stat for you, Stephen Kelly, that will please you. Spurs have won each of their past 4 Premier League home games against Manchester City without conceding a goal. So
I know it. Their record against them at their place, whether it be the new Tottenham Stadium or was it Wembley, I think they've only scored 1 game in five games against us. Like, it's a remarkable position to be in against while being the best team in the country for those years, those seasons. We just seem to have this thing over them, and I think City will be aware.
We may have lost Steve. Are you still with us, Stephen?
You gone there?
No, you're back with us. You're back with us. Go on.
I'm sorry. Sorry, I was saying, for all the teams to be going to play, City are probably looking at us and thinking, you know, it's just been our bogey team for such a long time now. You know, for as long as City have been dominant in the Premier League, Tottenham have had something over them, even in Champions League quarterfinals and things like that. So they're not going to think this is an easy game. But I think Mark is right. This is a very different Tottenham side, where end-to-end we leave ourselves exposed, and City can expose the best of teams. And with us pushing our fullbacks forward so high, there'll be spaces to get in behind us.
Mark, of course, that is the game for probably the title decider as such, but the other two games tonight both have implications for European football. Brighton v Chelsea, Manchester United versus Newcastle. Teams in 5th, 6th and 7th here all going at each other. What way do you see those games going?
Tomorrow night, those games, I think Newcastle got a very good chance. I know they've got a lot of injuries, Newcastle, but I still think they've got a very good chance of beating Manchester United, who I thought were all 4 again on Sunday. I know they kept the score respectable against Arsenal, but from an attacking point of view, just offered absolutely zero. And Newcastle, I think more likely to be playing European football next season. The other game, Chelsea against Brighton, I think is really interesting. Two teams that probably don't want the season to end. Chelsea definitely playing their best football, of the whole campaign. Brighton have just started to get their act together. A few players have come back from injury. they don't like Chelsea. You know, they Chelsea have sort of just taken all of their best players and all of their best coaching staff over the last couple of years. I wouldn't be surprised if Brighton got something from that game and sort of take sort of that Europa League spot right down to the end of the season.
I'm glad you mentioned those matches, Ruby, because just Brighton news, James Milner and Danny Welbeck have actually extended their contracts with the club. But for Manchester United, Varane has announced that he will leave Manchester United at the end of the season. Stephen, is this perfectly what Man United need to get rid of these big earners, if Martial goes as well, that they can then recruit efficiently, I suppose, as well?
Team.
Is this a start? Like, it's to get the lads on the big books that aren't really contributing.
Yeah, you have to have a clear, I think, at some point for United. And there's too many players there that just aren't pulling their weight. Listen, Varane came in on the back of being such a dominant centre back in European football for Real Madrid, and it just hasn't done it at United. He's been so off the pace, he's been injured all the time. So, you know, to get him off the wage bill, it's fantastic for United to have that money to go and spend. And if they get Martial off as well, which I'm sure they will, there's going to be a few more players that they'll probably sell, I would think. And their recruitment is going to have to scratch. But it's who they recruit. This is what's going to be down to. Man U have not recruited in the best of the last few years. And it's about now the new owners, the new directors. Who are they going to be identifying as the players they come in? Who's the manager that's going to manage them? Is it going to be Ten Hag that's having a chat with the board that who he wants, or is it going to be someone else? You know, they kind of need to sort that out as quick as possible so that they have a cohesive unit going forward and identifying the players they want.
Is that the most important thing, Mark, to not be, as Stephen kind of says, to not be targeting lads in their late 20s, even early 30s?
I definitely think that that's not the right way to approach it, because I mean, it's often been said that buying players from Real Madrid and Barcelona is a bad move because particularly Real Madrid, the only way is down. And why does anyone leave Real Madrid? Probably just for a pay packet, because you're at the club where you got sort of as good a chance as anywhere else of winning the European Cup, and they don't tend to sell sort of players at the peak of their powers. So I think I'd always be wary of buying players from Real Madrid. But Manchester United have also tried it the other way. I mean, Hoyland hasn't quite come off yet. They bought Sancho. That didn't come off. Mason Mount, that's not worked. So, I don't know, young players, older players, experienced ones. Nothing seems to really be working for United, which suggests, and I think everybody's already sort of said this, suggests the whole environment of the club is not built for success at the moment. I think that that's a long-term job to try to turn that around. I don't think you can do that overnight, but they're making steps in the right directions with all the changes they're making, I think, off the pitch.
They're trying to make changes, but Stephen Kelly, you did have high hopes early in the season for Chelsea. It's taken them a long time to turn around, but two wins at the end of the season could see them into sixth. It could be coming right for Chelsea.
Oh, yeah. No, it is. And it's weird. It is. It's very hard to look at Chelsea and think, what's wrong there? Why are they not doing it? Like, they've had an unbelievable amount of injuries. And I know there's been quite a few teams that have been plagued with injuries this season. But Chelsea have had like a huge numbers of what would be starting players missed for a long periods of time. The manager came in a bit of disarray with what's there and who the amount of players he had to deal with as well. So, but you do feel like there's a coming together. Cole Palmer has been a revelation. I would not have seen that happening the way it happened. Though when he signed there, I thought it's another player just adding to the numbers that's going to underachieve. But he is being sensational. And I think Pochettino has to be given credit because he's starting to make them look like a really strong side. And like I said, I think defensively they bring someone in. If they target at number 9, or if it even is Lukaku, who you never know could come back, they're going to be a side to be reckoned with. And I told you they'd have a say on the top of the table. They'd have a chance. I just hope they don't take Tottenham's spot. If they got two more wins, I think that potentially they could finish in fifth. But it's a long shot, I think, with Tottenham having Sheffield United last game of the season.
All the more reason for Spurs fans to want Spurs to win this evening. So we will be crossing live to Guy Swindles a little bit later in the show, who is at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. Stephen Kelly, before I let you go, though, as a former Ireland footballer who was from Dublin, I do have to ask if you have any memories of playing in the cathedral of football that is Talca Park back in the day.
Yes, I do indeed. Probably The biggest game I played in as a kid was there. So my first time ever representing Ireland in the 16s, it was in a competitive game. We played Sweden, Switzerland, and Wales in a mini group tournament to qualify for European Championships. We qualified at 16, which is amazing, but it was the first time playing in front of a stadium, in front of a crowd, really. And being from north side Dublin, being from not far from there, I still walk down to the stadium now myself when I'm back home to watch games, watching Duffer in charge. So yeah, I'm delighted with what's happened. Fair play to you, Shane, being involved, getting that kept. It's a memorable part of Irish football. It's huge. And to have something like that's going to be staying intact, it's massively important. I'd probably, again, over the years, snuck in a few times. You probably did as well, Shane. We probably shouldn't say that on air. when you could. It's one of those places that I've got great fond memories of. And like I said, at that age, to play in a stadium like that where, you know, at times there was, I think Paul Whelan was playing for Shells and his son Gavin I played with, and Ronnie Whelan's nephew. And I remember meaning a lot to me at the time. And yeah, starting off in what turned out to be a decent career.
If you keep praising Shane Dawson, he'll have you in charge of the fundraising committee. Back away from the phone pretty quick.
I'll see you Friday, Stephen. Yeah. We are taking a short break and we're back with Michael Corcoran on rugby, and we'll hear from the new Ulster permanent head coach, Richie Murphy.
Game on.
Rugby.
Now, you're very welcome back to Game On. Before we chat rugby, just an update on the Irish cricket match against Pakistan and Clontarf that we went to John Kenny on. Pakistan have won by 6 wickets in the 18th over to win the T20 series 2-1. So, unfortunate news for Irish cricket there. And also, Ruby, I did, during the break, I checked Twitter. Spurs are trolling their fans now by posting a picture of 3 academy players on Twitter in the build-up, because a lot of Spurs fans want them to play the academy team because that's how much they want to lose to Manchester City. So Spurs have just tweeted a picture of the 3 academy lads just to stir the pot a bit.
There you have it. I don't know what you call that in professional sport. I think we'll move swiftly on before we say something we shouldn't say. Anyway, I'm glad to say Michael Corcoran joined us on the line with some good news. Richie Murphy has been appointed the official head coach of Ulster. He was there on an interim basis, Corky, and good fit for the job.
He is, Ruby. He's got a really good track record. For most people at under 20 level over the last number of years. And the thing about it is, there's quite a lot of players who are involved with Ulster at the moment that he's coached at that level. Plus, he's got a very solid background as well. You know, he was involved with the Ireland senior team, and he was involved with Leinster for quite a period of time too. So he comes out with a good track record. He went in kind of halfway through the season, which in rugby terms is kind of slightly unusual, to be fair about it. He's kind of steadied the ship. And he's like steered them towards a place in the top 8 of the URC, which would, if they stay in the top 8, which would mean a place in the quarterfinal of the competition, more importantly, would also mean a place in the Investec Champions Cup for next season. So, look, I mean, he's a very, very positive individual. He's a really good man manager. He's a unique position. His 2 sons have played both scrum half and out half for the Irish in the 20s, and he's had a really good influence on them and their career as well too. So I think it's the correct appointment, and I think it's a really good one and a big opportunity for him to stamp his class, indeed stamp his mark on Ulster rugby for the next period of time.
Well, let's hear from the man himself. Richie Murphy was speaking to the Ulster Rugby social media channels.
I'm absolutely delighted, thrilled to be given the opportunity. Looking forward to the next 2 seasons with the lads. The first sort of 5-6 weeks that I've been here have been very exciting. Players have responded really well. Staff have been fantastic support to me, and so I'm really delighted that Bryn gave me the opportunity to come up here. We're obviously getting used to seeing where the squad is. I think a big part of my role will be to bring through some young players, some young Ulster players and Irish players up through the system and get them into the senior team. I think over the last couple of home games that we've had, we've seen some of that already starting to happen, and you know, there's plenty of guys in competition for training has gone up a level, which is brilliant. So one of my main focuses will be to bring through some of those young players.
And what does a Richie Murphy team look like in your eyes, and what qualities does it have?
I think clarity, you know what I mean, around what they're doing and what they've been asked to do is a huge thing. I think players stepping up and taking ownership is a big thing that we want to try and drive. And competition for places on a training basis, guys getting rewarded for showing form and working really hard. And if we can sort of bring all those things in, I think we've become very competitive. You know, we're still very much at an early stage in relation to my time being here. So trying to take it game by game, it's a boring old one, but players have responded, as I say, really well. And everyone's working hard to try and make sure that we make the playoffs. And if you can get into the playoffs, you can see anything can happen. Munster, obviously, last year qualified quite a long way down and went through and ended up winning it. So.
Game on.
Rugby.
Michael, clarity is a word Richie Murphy used there for his team, but I suppose clarity for Irish rugby. Irish rugby does need Ulster to be performing and be competitive, so this is a pretty big job for him.
It is, yeah, Ruby. I mean, like, we've only got four teams in the country at that level, so we actually need all four of them to be pretty competitive. And, you know, it's probably fair to say that Ulster have underperformed, given the talent that they've had for the last number of years. They've underperformed at the top table, you know, for a period of time. And I just think Richie going in there is a real breath of fresh air there. He's also in a situation like where he doesn't have any baggage. It's not an internal appointment from within the province or within the team. So he's coming from the outside in with a proven track record. One of the things he mentioned there is about bringing through younger players. And, you know, when you see some of the younger players that Ulster have, you know, Cormac Isichigu, Harry Sheridan and people like that. It's a big chance. You see fellas like Eric O'Sullivan, who were on the periphery for, you know, the last period of time, and he's an international rugby player. And it's good to see. I mean, Richie will give people a chance, and he'll give them a chance to prove themselves, but they'll have to prove themselves on a training pitch first before they earn the right to play in the starting team. And maybe that's something that hasn't been there, you know, in the last while, but certainly, I mean, the players have responded very, very positively to him and what he's done in the short space of time that he's there.
So good news for Ulster Rugby, for Richie Murphy's appointment. However, bad news, Ian Henderson has been ruled out of action for 3 months and will miss Ireland's summer tour of South Africa. The Ulster captain has undergone toe surgery and is expected to be sidelined until the middle of August. Ireland will play 2 tests against world champions in July. Just on the topic of Ulster, James Hume also has undergone surgery on his knee. Luke Marshall and Rob Balakoon are unavailable for this weekend's Inter-Pro with Leinster in Belfast. Luke Marshall due to concussion and Rob Balakoon with a hamstring injury. Michael, just how gut-wrenching is this for Ian Henderson?
Well, it's a season-ending thing, that's the reality, but he's been troubled by that foot injury for a period of time, even during the course of the Six Nations Championship, where, you know, he was kind of nursed along, really, to be fair. So they try. I mean, the one thing about the medical staff at the RFU, they don't take any chances at all, but they'll try and avoid surgery if they can to try and rehab you and help you along. But then there reaches a stage where, you know, you reach a crossroads in the way that's been done. So surgery is the only option that was available for him. So it's a disappointing end of the season for him that he doesn't, you know, that he doesn't play for Ulster anymore and misses that tour to South Africa as well. There'll be a lot of people would like to be on that tour, because that's already the start of the building phase for next season. So that's a big disappointment. That's a big disappointment for Ian Henderson. And an even bigger one for Rory O'Loughlin, the former Leinster and Exeter and Ireland centre, who's had to retire today because of a shoulder injury. And, I mean, he's still a young man, has been with Exeter for the last number of seasons, played really well for them and performed at a good level, scored some really good tries when he was wearing the blue of Leinster for a period of time. And as a younger man, you know, for to finish your career, to finish your dream is over. To turn the page and have to start a new chapter, the next chapter, whatever that brings him, it's gut-wrenching for a player at any level, at any sport, to have to give up on your dream.
Never an easy thing to do. We wish him the best of luck with that journey. Not much good news either for Connacht. They were hoping to have Mac Hansen back for the Stormers game at the weekend in Galway, but Pete Wiggins has had to give up on that quest, I suppose.
Yeah, again, you know, again, they don't do. It's the risk thing. It's the same with Mac Hansen there, the same with Gary Ringrose for Leinster. I mean, if you're not 100%, you're you're not there. Nobody will take a chance. That's the reality about it. You could do more damage, Ruby, you know yourself, if you're not 100%. You could do more damage long term. That's the reality. It's been a frustrating time for Connacht because they've missed Santiago Cordero, the Argentinian who they signed, and he got injured in pre-season. He's been out for the entire season. Mac Hansen obviously missing for a long period of time as well too. I mean, what a difference the two of them would make now, or would have made even last Saturday night down in Thoma Park against Munster, where they were well beaten. You know, they play the Stormers this week and they've Leinster in their last game and they have to win one of their two last games to make it into the top eight, to make the knockout stages and make the Champions Cup again next year. But yeah, frustrating time, but look, what can you do about it? All you can do is just rehab, do your rehab, put in the hard work and try and come back fitter and stronger than ever before.
We wish them the best with that. And finally, Corky, before we let you go, Bundy Aki, Dan Sheehan, Gibson Park, all nominated for the Rugby Player Ireland Awards. Hardly a shock. Who would you go for?
Oh, I was hoping you weren't going to ask me that, because I looked at the three of them and in the time while I was waiting to come on, I think I changed my mind at least twice. I mean, sorry, can I deflect for a second and say, if you look at the men's young player of the year, I mean, ordinarily you'd say Jack Crowley is a great chance of winning it, but then he's up against Joe McCarthy and Tom Ahern. So pick one of the three of them. Or indeed, I mean, the women's awards are equally very, very well contested as well too. Brittany Hogan, Aveen Riley and Aoife Way for the women's players' player of the year. If you're to pick the men's players' player of the year, I don't have a vote, obviously, because I'm not a player, but I would say possibly Bundy Aki might be favourite to win that, given the performances that he put in during the Rugby World Cup, where he was absolutely sensational all the way through it.
Well answered.
Certainly was.
Well answered.
Gibson Park will run him close, and Jack Crowley surely taking over from Johnny Sexton is a shoe-in for Young Player of the Year.
How many shoe-ins have there been in the horse racing? Yeah. Anyway, we're going to that.
On that note, gentlemen, we are going to take a break. Michael Corcoran, thank you very much. Shane Stokes is up next with cycling, and indeed we'll be crossing live to the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium to join Guy Swindle. Stick with us here in Game On 2FM.
Game On 2FM.
Welcome back to Game On. We're going to turn our attention to cycling, where stage 10 of the Giro d'Italia was completed this afternoon. And Shane Stokes, cycling journalist, joins us on the line. And Tadej Pogacar, he's well on the road, isn't he?
He is, yeah. How are you doing? It's looking pretty good. He's been really dominant this year, and that dominance has only continued in this race. He's well clear of the rest after last week's opening week. He's 2:40 ahead of Danny Martinez, who's his closest rival, with Geraint Thomas at 2:58. So, yeah, those gaps are pretty big for 10 days into a race like this. It's pretty interesting.
On this stage in particular, Shane, can you just put into words just how grueling, how tough this final climb in stage 10? I see Valentin Paré-Pentré of the Catalan AG2R Le Mondial launched a late attack in the final climb. But even just looking at some of the pictures, like, it looks ridiculously steep.
It does, No, it is. It is very, very much a difficult climb. What's interesting is that it's only 1,389 meters. In height, so it's actually, the climbs can go up to 1,000 meters more than that, and they will later in this race. So, which is, it's difficult, and it will be very difficult for you and you or I. There are harder ones in cycling, so I suppose that puts it into context that you can look at TV, see how difficult it is, and it can become even more arduous than that. So, but certainly, the longer a race goes on, that's also a factor that increases the relative difficulty of them as well, because, you know, you're 10 days into the race, there'll be some very tough ones coming close to the end of the race. The race is 21 stages long. So the fatigue only accumulates as time goes on, which could well produce bigger time gaps as we get into that final week of racing.
This race is looking like it's sort of over. Pogacar has won three stages 2, 7 and 10, and he's just going to ride it out to the end. Tactically, what do the other teams start to do now? Do they start to turn an eye to the Tour? Do they start trying different things? Or do they just keep going and trying to eat into that lead?
Yeah, they just really have to keep going. Geraint Thomas, who's won the Tour de France in the past, was second overall in the Giro d'Italia last year. He actually led into the final time trial, but then was overtaken by Primoz Roglic, who isn't in the race this year. He said they just really have to stick to their plan and keep going and see what happens. Pogacar has been really dominant. He's won two Tours de France in the past, and he's really the preeminent racer at the moment. He's been compared to Eddie Merckx, who was the all-time great. And before this race, he's been quite selective in the amount of racing he's done this year. He only did 10 days of racing prior to the Giro and won 7 times in that, which is a staggering win rate in a sport like cycling, where you've got up to 200 competitors in the field. So, yeah, he's been on superb form, and it was widely expected that he would dominate the opening week. What was interesting today and what those rivals will look to is that he was quite conservative. He wasn't attacking. He followed wheels today, and actually at the end of the race was a little bit subdued in his post-race interviews. He's quite charismatic. He's usually quite playful in terms of how he interacts with the media and that, and comes across as having a ball of a time. Like he really does love the sport and loves racing, but seemed a little bit subdued. So he has had a stuffed nose the last couple of days, which did sound clearer today, but there are rumours a fever is going around the race, and some riders did indeed retire. So there was speculation today, you know, could he be ill? Could there be something that he's under the weather? Or, as sometimes happens, the first day after a rest day, riders can be quite stiff and just not quite feel themselves. So what his rivals will look to is the last two editions of the Tour de France, where he unexpectedly cracked in those races and went on to finish second rather than win the race, and they'll be hoping for a repeat of that. But yeah, we'll have to wait and see what happens, but they will look to that previous frailty and keep fingers crossed that something like that does occur.
Look, he's been not equated to or likened to Eddie Merckx, and Merckx did the double in 70, 72 and 74, winning the Giro and the Tour. Is that what Pogacar is thinking about? Is that what he's got his goal set as for the year? Stephen Ross did it in 87, Ian Durand did it in 92 and 93.
Yeah, and Marco Pantani was the last to do it way back in 1998, which is, what, 26 years ago now. So, and that shows how difficult the feat is. He surprised in the winter. In December, he declared that he was going to go for the Giro Tour double, and people were, because of the rarity of it in the modern era, that was one surprise. And the second was that he has lost those last two tours to Jonas Vingegaard, and a lot of people thought that he would just maybe stake everything on the Tour this year and try and get back his crown. But instead, he's increased the difficulty for himself in taking on these two major targets, because racing the Giro almost always makes you fatigued for the Tour. So it's a bit of a gamble. But what's also interesting and what should be considered is that having won the Tour in 2020 and 2021, he was the favourite going into 2022. And had completely overraced that year. He had 26 days of racing prior to that tour, and just ran out of steam during the race, and said the following year he was going to do less racing, but actually did quite a similar amount early on the year, but then crashed in Liège-Bastogne-Liège, fractured his wrist and had quite a compromised preparation for the race. So he was very strong in the tour. Vingegaard got an early advantage, and then Pogacar took time out of him on two different stages. But then cracked on stage 16 and stage 17. He slipped right back, and that was put down to probably the compromised preparation with the wrist fracture and the amount of time he had to take off the bike. So the thinking was that he would stake everything on being at his best the Tour this year, and he could well be, but just going via the Giro is a slightly more complicated route. So a lot of people are watching this very keenly.
Away from the Giro, just before we do let you go, Shane, you and I were chatting last week on Sam Bennett and what is up next for Sam. He was third today on the opening stage of the 4 days of Dunkirk, I'm right in saying?
Yeah, and paradoxically, it's a six days long race, so it's one of those kind of quirks. It was originally 4 days, and that's where the title came from, and they never changed it. Oh, okay. So what that translates into is all bar possibly one stage that there should be multiple sprint opportunities. Third today, he hasn't raced much at all in the last while. He's done just one race in the last 6 or 7 weeks, and the reason is because he wanted to work on, he was very fit this year and climbing very well and riding well, but just didn't quite have his usual edge in the sprints. So he's gone off and he's done a lot of gym training. He's done a lot of intensive sprint training on the bike. And this is him returning to competition and hoping that he's got the missing piece of the jigsaw in place. So third day was good. He wasn't quite in the right position at the end, and he looked probably not quite as sharp as he would be had he been racing. So he'll take encouragement from the third place and hope that things pick up in the coming days. And Sam is very much a rider that is driven by morale and by success. And the feeling is that if he gets one win, that'll open the floodgates and more could come. And you remember he won the green jersey in two stages in the Tour 4 years ago, hasn't ridden the Tour de France since. And the big goal is to be back there and be winning again. And races like this are key in getting his morale up and just getting the momentum going again.
Well, it would be great to see him back in the Tour de France. Shane Stokes, thanks a million for taking our call this evening. We're going to go straight over to Tottenham Hotspur Stadium now to see what the build-up is like. Guy Swindles is there for us. Guy, how are the Tottenham fans behaving?
The Tottenham fans are behaving pretty well, but they are in a confused mood. Yes, they would like to continue their wonderful run against Manchester City in the last four league matches here that City have visited the new Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. City haven't scored and Spurs have won all four. However, should that happen tonight, then Arsenal are favourites to win the title, which would upset this side of North London quite dramatically. So, yeah, there's a slightly schizophrenic feel about this evening.
Are there a lot of empty seats? I know, listen, we're over an hour away from kickoff, but perhaps Spurs fans don't want to see the inevitable happen.
Possibly yes, but at the same time, it's the final home game of the season. It is against Manchester City. So again, we've got this, I don't want to see Arsenal win the league, but I really want to see us play Manchester City in our final game of the season. So in fact, considering we're an hour before kickoff, there's a remarkable number of fans already sitting down in the ground. So I have a feeling it might fill up just about kickoff time.
Well, maybe it will. Hopefully it'll be an entertaining game for us neutrals. Guy, thanks a million for taking our quick call and a quick visit to London to see how the build-up is going. I bet you they'll give them a game. It would be some turnaround, wouldn't it?
Oh, they absolutely will. 3-3 in December, and the way Ange plays. We were mentioning earlier, Ruby, and we are stuck for time now, just before we go, about Ange's style of play. Like, the matches that Spurs grinded out against City with Jose Mourinho was a bit more of a pragmatic approach, where this is just going to be carnage, and it's exactly what we want, Ruby.
With a bit of luck, we'll get it. Shane Dawson, thanks for your company this evening.
Been a pleasure. Happy birthday again, Ruby. Enjoy the rest of your birthday evening. We will be back tomorrow. We have two Donegal legends on the show, Nadine Doherty and Shay Given. We'll also be chatting to Damien Lawler and we'll be previewing provincial action in the Camogie Leagues as well. So lots to look forward to, 6 o'clock tomorrow. Do stay tuned to 2FM because Beda da Silva is up next with some cracking music from myself and Ruby. Thank you to Ronan Lawler and Laura Lee Davis from all of the Game On team. It is. Bye for now. RTE 2FM.